Let's take our Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 48, and we are, God willing, going to finish the book of Genesis tonight. I know that I took a couple weeks longer than I said to finish the book of Genesis, but we'll see if we can't finish Genesis this evening. Chapter 48. Now, beginning, I would actually, you don't need to turn there, but I'd like to call your attention actually back a few chapters. In chapter 42, verse 18 of the book of Genesis, Joseph made what was probably just accepted by us as just a passing remark. In a conversation with his brothers, he said, "Do this, for I fear God. Do this, for I fear God." And certainly as we're coming to the end of the book of Genesis, it's been a long journey. Even this time that we've spent with Joseph has been a long time. And looking back now in the life of Joseph and reflecting upon his lifetime, his ministry, I think we might wonder if there was anything that singled Joseph out. I mean, was there anything, and if there was, what was it, that made him special before God, that kind of put him up front, that God would choose him to be so greatly used in the kingdom and in history? It seems that throughout Joseph's lifetime, his journey's path, if you will, came to one single thought, and that is, he feared God. He feared God. Now, that's an idea that really has been seemingly lost in our generation. We don't live in a generation that likes to speak of fearing God. I mean, that is so far away from where the church really exists today, which is really a land of fluff and feel-good kind of ideology, that we've lost this idea of fearing God. But I want you to notice that Joseph feared God. I think few people today exist in that realm, that they grasp that kind of relationship with their Creator. And frankly, we, because we're lacking in that fear of God, we so oftentimes act against God and against His Word. And in doing so, it just expresses to the world that we do lack that fear and we lack that respect in our Creator. We so oftentimes deal with God in a realm where we believe somehow that what we do is in secret. We tend to give ourselves what I call special sin exemptions. For Joseph, his love for his God was made manifest by more than mere words. I mean, this was something that he lived out. He lived out his love. He acted in his respect and in his fear of God. But again, I don't know that we really think about that too much, that we fear God. I mean, we tend to operate in a realm where we don't fear God. I think a lot of us do indeed grant ourselves those special sin exemptions. We have secret lies and secret sins. We involve ourselves in things that are perhaps immoral, against the Spirit of God. Oftentimes they're illegal. And we support illegal activities, because we believe somehow that we have a special reason to do so, but it's sin. And there's going to come a reckoning day, because we don't fear God. See, God was to Joseph an ever-present reality. Joseph was one of those guys, according to the Word, that always had God beside him. He had a relationship with God. He walked with God. Every decision, every direction that he pursued was through God. And more importantly, for God. And I wonder how many of us base our decisions these days on what is good for God. So often we go to God, and as I've said many times, we try to get Him on our bandwagon instead of getting on His. You see, Joseph albeit he lived many years before Matthew 6:33 was penned, he lived by its call anyway. And here it is in the New Living. And he will give you, this being God, and he will give you all that you need from day to day if you live for him and make the kingdom of God your primary concern. That's a great promise, isn't it? We know the verse, seek first the kingdom of God. That's what it is in King James. But I love that living. He'll give you all that you need from day to day if you live for him and make the kingdom of God your primary concern. Is God your primary concern tonight? Is living for God your primary concern? Let me tell you something, gang. And you're going to be hearing more about this in the days and weeks to come because it's something rattling around in your pastor's head. But we are living in an age where I don't think it's a surprise to anyone. It's a precarious time out there, isn't it? Economically, spiritually, I mean, it's just crazy out there, isn't it? Christian, we need to live our lives different than the world. Now, we can act now to move to do certain things in our lives to prepare for what is coming. It's not going to get better. I'm sorry. Rain on your parade, right? You know, tomorrow there'll just be thousands of new jobs created and the stocks are going to go up and there's going to be peace in Afghanistan and the Middle East and all the rest. Probably not. What's our reaction as Christians? What should we be doing? Well, one, I really think that we need to simplify our lives. Create an air of simplicity in our lives where we do not have so many things going on. That we live our lives in a simplicity where we have time for each other. Time for our families. Time for this family. Time to serve the Lord. Time to be in fellowship. We also, and you're hearing this from the world too. Also, we need to not spend more money than we're earning. We need to be examples of credit and how we handle our money. I think a lot of us, even here today, and I don't know anything about you guys' credit, but I'm guessing a lot of us probably need to take our credit cards and chop them in two. It's just too high interest anyway, gang, isn't it? We need to live according to our means. Simplify our lives. Find the pleasures that God has created in this world instead of constantly buying and entertaining ourselves into this state of mind where we don't have time for God. We don't have time to grow close and to learn and to equip ourselves. What's going to happen is a lot of people are going to ignore the words I'm saying to you right now. And when things get tough, and this ain't nothing, when things get tough, we're going to see a lot of people fold. They're going to decide they want the world far more than they want to walk with God. Let's try to learn something from Joseph as we go through this. That we don't make the same mistakes. That we live in holiness. That we live in sanctification. That we live for God and through God. Where are you? We're just flying through these three chapters, aren't we? We'll make it. Verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed, your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, look, your son Joseph is coming to you. And Israel strengthened himself. And he sat up on the bed. And then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz, and that's Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and blessed me. And he said to me, behold, I'll make you fruitful and multiply you. I'll make you a multitude of people. I'll give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. Okay, we'll stop right there for just a second. The time had come now, as it is going to come for all of us, that Jacob is getting ready to depart this world. He's going to now go stand before Jehovah God. I want you to notice that even in his last days, even as he's departing this world, Jacob's thoughts were upon God and his promises. What a very, very smooth and cool way to exit, isn't it? I hope I could exit with that kind of class. God had said. Those were Jacob's words. God has said. Jacob is going to take it to the bank. He wasn't just going to hear what God had to say. He was going to believe what God had to say. Let's go on. Verse 5, "And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath," that is, Bethlehem. Jacob does something here, if you can catch it through the text here. Jacob does something that really has a very profound effect upon the course of the Jewish nation from this point forward. Even to today, what is occurring here in the text is affecting the Jewish world, and thus us adopted Jews, is affecting us even to today. He is effectively adopting Joseph's sons here as his own. And what does that mean? Well, by doing that, he's now going to place them in a position of equal billing, if you will, as far as his inheritance is concerned. So the two boys now would receive a portion equal to the other sons of Jacob. They would be forever now listed as the father of two of the tribes of Israel. It's important. Joseph here is effectively then given a double portion of the inheritance. Let me tell you something, a truth tonight. God is still seemingly giving out those double portions. He's very willing to give out double portions to his inherited kids, to all those who are willing to be so committed to him as Joseph. Some of you are recipients of that double portion, I know. You live like it. You live in that realm. It's all about God. And the more you try to give to him, the more he just gives back. Verse 8, "Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?' And Joseph said to his father, 'They are my sons, whom God has given me in this place.' And he said, 'Please bring them to me, and I will bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them, and he embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has shown me your offspring.' So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near him. Then Israel stretched out his right hand, and he laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph, and he said, 'God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life, longed to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth.' Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took his hold of his father's hand, and he removed it from Ephraim's head and put it on Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, 'Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head.' But his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations.' So he blessed them that day, saying, 'By you, Israel, will I bless. May God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh.' And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow.'" Now, I hope you catch the story here. I mean, really, irony here, turning the pages of history. Jacob, having once conned his father into giving him, the younger brother, the birthright so many years before, and now these years had brought him full circle. Now he's the one on the other side of the table, if you will. And he knowingly this time gives the birthright blessing to the younger son, the son of Joseph. Now, Jacob's prophecy here concerning Ephraim was absolutely correct. That's the advantage we have of being able to know the end of the story. Now, we don't have maybe the credits quite yet, but we certainly see a lot of what Jacob was speaking to Joseph here. Because Ephraim would now, one day, his name would become so powerful and so great within Israel, it would become equal, synonymous with the name Israel. So sometimes as we go on into the Old Testament here, I'm going to be reading and it's going to refer to Ephraim when they're speaking of all of Israel. That's how powerful the younger son of Joseph would become and how prominent he would come within the Jewish nation. Verse 1, chapter 49. Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." Now, what's going to happen here is something very interesting. Because what is occurring here is actually the reading of the will, I guess you could say. But the only difference is Jacob still alive? Wouldn't we all like to do that? I think that'd be a very cool thing. To be able to gather everybody together and just divvy up everything while you're still alive. That's what's going on here. So now he's gathering them all together and he's going to read the will. Now Reuben, he was the oldest. He was in a position for a great blessing, great prominence. But see, we have the advantage of knowing the story of the lives of all of these men that are here gathered around their father. And when it comes to Reuben, his flesh had caused him now to be set aside. Please note that this evening. His flesh is now going to force him to be set aside and others would receive the blessing that should have been his. In fact, when we look into the historical aspects of the tribe of Reuben, we see that no prophet, no judge, no hero would ever come from the family of Reuben. This is it. End of the road. He was, in Jacob's words here, unstable as water. Verse 4. There's no consistency in Reuben's life. There was no continuity in his relationship with God and with the people around him. Not vertical, not horizontal. And having that continuity, having that consistency in one's life is required to be greatly blessed by God. It was then, it is tonight. This goes back to what I was saying earlier. Some of us live lives that are so confusing and so we're running around just like crazy people here and there, and we live lives that are a mile wide and an inch deep. There's no depth to anything we do because we're just so busy and the world is dictating that. And our walk with Christ is up and down and we're doing our devotions and then we're not doing our devotions. And then we come to church and we tell our kids, follow God. But we go home and we don't follow God. We break the law. We involve ourselves in things that are immoral, unlawful, and all the rest. And then we expect our kids to grow up for Jesus. And all these aspects of our lives are happening. And we wonder why God isn't blessing us in great ways. We need to stop, take a step back, and clear the table. Christian, we're not to live like the rest of the world with just a little bit of Jesus in it. But how many of us live that way? We live like them. We entertain ourselves like them. We buy the same stuff as them. We're consumed by the same products as them. We're busy about the same activities as them. And then put a little Jesus in my life. It doesn't work that way. It's got to be all about Jesus. And I realize that message makes some of us here tonight uncomfortable. Are they sort of all of nothing, all or nothing kind of message? Well, let me tell you something. As long as I'm still breathing and I'm in this pulpit, that message isn't going to go away. It's the message that we need to hear in 2010. Because that little morsel of Jesus you're hanging on to, when things get tough, you're going to let go of Jesus and you're going to hold on to the TV set and the iPod and the job and the financial security and the health insurance and all the things that make us feel like we're on firm ground. Unstable as water. I'd like to go down in history with that label. I'd put that on your tombstone. Unstable as water. No doubt, Reuben was living his life in a presumptuous state, just like so many of us do. We often do this, as I say, even as Christians. He was no doubt believing that he could live any way he wished and that God would still give him all the blessings that were to be had. You know, because he believed. And so we can do that. Well, I'm a Christian. So God's just going to automatically just give me all there is to have. Doesn't work like that. I don't know if we're just waiting for mail delivery. You know, God's just going to send it to us in the mail. You have to put yourself in a lifestyle that allows for God to do these great and abundant things in your life. I'm not preaching works tonight. I'm not talking about the fact that it's you. I'm saying placing yourself in the realm. It works the opposite too. You got a drinking problem? Do you hang out in bars? You say, as a matter of fact, I do. You're going to have a drinking problem. It's like, I'll just have a Coke, you know, down at the pub. Yeah, maybe the first time, that'll be rum and Coke. It works the opposite too. You place yourself in situations where God can bless you. You know, one of the things you're doing right, you're here. I hope you're here not out of obligation or some sort of political thing. Oh, I don't come on Wednesday night, people will talk, they'll think I'm not a Christian. Stay home. I'm talking about being in a situation where you want to be discipled, you want to grow, you want to have that fellowship and that dynamic going on in your life. So that's a good step. Some of you are in extra classes. You're in the believers class or the disciples or the ministry class. And some of you are in other ministry groups, you know, the Gnosko and or the singles and the couples and street level. All those different things going on because you're hungry. You want to put yourself in a situation where God can do these great things in your life. Unstable as water. Reuben found out the truth the hard way. God doesn't work that way. And he doesn't, not then, he doesn't now. With blessings come responsibility and come faithful living. Jacob here cites one particular sin when it came to Reuben. And if you've been around here a long time, you recall that Reuben at one time had slept with his dad's concubine. What Jacob was doing with the concubine, I had the foggiest idea. But anyway, that's the way it was. And he slept with his concubine. And you know what? Spiritually or even socially, that didn't go down at all. So he trashed his future. He trashed the opportunity for God to manifest himself grand in Reuben's life. Was he still loved? You bet. Are you still loved? No matter what you do? To God, and yes, those sins that you're doing, they are actually to God. I always liken those overt transgression sins as it would be the same as if you walked up to the cross with my Savior hanging on it and you spit on him. That's the way I look at it. Like you don't even care whether he died for you. And that's the situation here. He trashed his future. He did what he knew was to wrong. And let me tell you something. And I touched a little bit upon this on Sunday. The truth is, we can indeed act in ways of sin before God that can close doors on God's best plans for us for the rest of our lives. I know that's hard for us to accept. I mean, we love our grace here at Jesus Fellowship, don't we? We embrace the idea that God is so forgiving, and He is, and you are, and I am the living example of that. We are the embodiment of God's forgiveness. But to somehow believe that I can live as I please against God's will and go out and do things that He has told me not to do and come back from that, the old saying goes. I mean, we've all heard it before. You know, if I want to be in the Olympics and I'm gonna be a sprinter out there, and can I hang around the track? Eating those little chocolate donuts cereal that Belushi talked about. Yeah, isn't that great for those of you old enough? Little chocolate donuts. He's hanging out there smoking cigarettes and everything. Can I eat those little chocolate donuts cereal, and smoke cigarettes, hang around the track, Can I do that and run? Yeah, probably. You just can't win. Now we know that, right? It works the same way with faith. It works the same way with God. Don't check your brain at the door. God's a God of logic. That's the way it works. Verse 5 says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united in their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. So now, in a secondary thing, he deals with the two brothers here. And this ain't good. Both of these, if you recall what happened in this situation, these two boys were guilty of murder back in Shechem. It's a whole other story, but if you recall, going on verses, where are we, 19? Did I skip something here? We're going to go to 19 because I lost a page. Oh, there it is. Verse 8. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Binding his donkey to the vine, and his donkey colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes... Oh my. His clothes the blood of grapes, his eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. So now... Judah, he was the first one of the sons here. He would actually get a good inheritance, which is amazing because we know Judah did not do so good early on. He made things right. Judah would now, and the tribe of Judah would inherit the birthright regarding government. It would be this tribe's rule that would guide all the tribes in the future. And we'll see as we get into this, as we go further into the Old Testament. It would be Judah's guidance as far as government that would hold all these tribes together in a cohesive union to be a nation. 13 says, Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. Now, what he's saying here is the tribe of Zebulun would be keen to ships and ocean commerce. Now, if you are a sharp student of the word, you're going to go, that never happened. And you're absolutely right. It didn't happen in the Old Testament time. Why? Because the tribe of Zebulun's land was landlocked. So what are we talking about here? Well, first of all, I'd like to say right up front, I have the foggiest idea. Okay? I can give you some hypothesis. Could have been the fault of the people, number one. That they weren't where they were supposed to be in order to fulfill God's prophecy concerning them. And we already discussed that tonight, that can happen. Secondly, there's those who believe that this is what is going to be their position in the millennium reign. I don't have time tonight to get into the whole millennium reign thing. This is post-rapture, post-second coming, second earth, millennium reign of Christ. That at that time, that this will happen. Many commentators believe that what it is they did indeed benefit from ocean trade because they were in the perfect line that all the merchants that were traveling would, on their way to the ocean shipping, that the caravans would go right through their land. And so they did benefit financially from all of that, even though they didn't have any shores that were on the ocean. Issachar is a strong donkey, verse 14, there you go. You want to be go down history for that, right? Is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. History will bear out that Issachar had no stomach for war. They were a tribe that was rather pacifist. They eventually became slaves to conquering nations. Take a good military lesson from that one, right? Verse 16, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. The tribe of Dan would go on now to be the judges of Israel. They apparently, according to this text and elsewhere, they apparently fell into some disfavor, ill repute somewhere along the way. Because we can't really know for sure what we're talking about here, but it doesn't sound good, does it? This could be in reference to the fact that there would be an introduction of idolatry into the nation of Israel along the way. Many people blame the tribe of Dan for that idolatry entering into Israel, and ultimately they would fall to their enemies because of this idolatry. Also, again, if you're a sharp Bible student, you may know that many commentators believe this passage is a veiled reference to the rise of the Antichrist, which many commentators believe is going to come out of the tribe of Dan. And if that is true, or either of these is true, it would explain why later passages that have tribal listings, 1 Chronicles 2, 3, 8, 40, and Revelation 3, or 7, 3 through 8, does not mention the tribe of Dan at all. So things didn't go well for them. Let's see if I can find my missing page now. Gad. Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, verse 19, but he shall triumph at last. Now, Gad was constantly being attacked by enemies after the nations were settled. Why? They were on the wrong side of the River Jordan, remember? They were like, you know, we like this land over here. We're gonna hang over here. And they would eventually be one of the first to fall to the enemies. Why? Because they weren't holding tightly to the unity of their brothers and sisters in God. They were kind of looking for a compromise, and they paid for that compromise. Verse 20, bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Isn't that nice? Land of Asher later on would be the breadbasket of Israel. They would have the fertile soil. They would have the abundance of crops. They were the Iowa of Israel. Okay. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. That's pretty deep too. We do know that Naphtali would go on to be a very strong and independent-minded mountain people. They kind of hung on their own, did their own thing, but they did have a reputation of being some fierce warriors. You didn't want to mess with Naphtali. Joseph is a fruitful bough, verse 22, by a well, his branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bough remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. by the God of your Father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of your Father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. I was like poetry, wasn't it? I mean, that's very flowery speech. I don't know that I can extrapolate a whole lot out of that, but it sounds good. I'll take that one. The promise of Joseph was a beautiful picture. It reflected the character of a man that was chosen by God. Despite the difficulties of his life, despite all the hardship that we've been going through, we were very cognizant tonight of all the stuff that Joseph had gone through. Even through all that stuff, gang, he remained true. He remained strong. He would be like Paul in the New Testament that would get to the very end of his life and would be able to say, you know what, I finished well. I finished well. Verse 27, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. Benjamin would go on to be the most fierce warriors in all of Israel. They weren't a big tribe, but they were mean, boy. They were an army to be reckoned with. All of these 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. He charged them, and he said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with the fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham brought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. They buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife, there. They buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife, and there buried Leah. The field and the cave there is that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. I want to do that. I mean, isn't that cool? It's like, all right, I'm going to tell all you guys, all you right boys, what you get nothing. You've been a bad boy. You get it all. You've been really good. Okay, I'm leaving now. Just die right there. Wouldn't that be great? That's just, you gotta admire that kind of an exit. That was awesome. Chapter 50, verse 1. And Joseph fell on his father's face. He wept over him and he kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. That's really nice, because he wasn't even of their people. And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke of the household of Pharaoh, saying, Yo, Pharaoh, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am dying in my grave, which I have dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I'll come back. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house. Only their little ones and their flocks and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And they there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. And then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw that the mourning of the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as property for the burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt. he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and will actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So they were having a hard time still shaking the guilt here. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, hey, before Dad died, he commanded you saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespasses of your brothers and their sin, for they did no evil to you. Remember that? Remember when Dad said that? Now please forgive the trespasses of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also went, and they fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I'll provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, I'll hearken back to one passage before we leave this, and that's verse 20 of this last chapter. Joseph, speaking to his brother, says, but as for you, you meant evil for me, but God meant it for good. That's a famous verse. In this verse, this epilogue, if you will, of Joseph's, it really embodies, encompasses the whole of Joseph's life. You know what? We know that much of his life, Joseph had it hard. And there was nothing fair about Joseph's early life. How many of us are quick to say, you know what? That's just not fair. God isn't being fair. This isn't fair. Why am I getting this? This isn't fair. And we go on like that. But you know what? His life was not fair. And frankly, guys, I don't know that anyone's life is all that fair. He wrongfully suffered much at the hands of other people. But you know what? Through it all, and we know the story, through it all, he trusted God to handle things, and because he trusted God to handle things, God handled things. God did. He put himself in a situation where God could bless him. He feared God. He put himself in the place where God could control his life, and God controlled his life. Joseph didn't struggle against what God was trying to do in his life. Joseph didn't, can't you do this? That's not fair, God. I really wanted this. I wanted a big house. Where's my Porsche, God? You know, where's my stuff? In the end of his life, Joseph outlasted his enemies and he prospered before God. You know something I've learned? Nothing shuts the mouths of those who rally against you as much as kingdom success and bountiful fruit. It's hard to argue against that, isn't it? I mean, they can say what they want. I mean, and they really dissed Joseph, especially early in his life. But the end, he had the mo going. He had it. Not necessarily the stuff. I'm not talking about material possessions. He had the hand of God on him, and everybody knew it. So despite all the hard stuff, despite all that he went through, Joseph still lived his life in harmony, didn't he? I mean, Joseph lived in the world, but he never lived part of the world. Even a second
to the Pharaoh. He was always like, I mean, he was there, but he was just never really one of them. You know, he just was able to pull that off. Are you able to pull that off? Because Joseph was always focused upon and working for the kingdom and the God who owned it. I mean, he was Joseph. He lived and he died the servant of God. And you know what? I don't know anything that would be better said of any of us after we're gone. Amen.